welcome to our service today. I hope that everyone's enjoying this nice summer weather, the record-breaking heat. It can be pretty tough, but I, for one, am not looking forward to winter. I'll take it. Just need a shade tree and a fan or a breeze, and you'll be all right. Today, I wanted to speak about attitude. In fact, how to cultivate or maintain a good attitude. And, you know, at times it's not easy. And in times we live in, it seems like there's trouble and dissension and just plain violence everywhere in the news and the world, close to home even. And I think it can sometimes kind of depress us, you know, when we see so much of this. And it's pretty easy to get discouraged or sad or even angry and depressed, especially in, you know, the political year. We're electing a president, and that seems to divide the people at least into two camps, if not more. And, you know, it's easy to get upset and sometimes say things that we might regret later. So I think it's best that if we remember that God is in charge, even with all of the things that are happening in the world, some things must happen before His kingdom. So we may not always get the leaders we want or we think we need. I sometimes worry that we might get the ones we deserve. That's kind of scary, but I won't pursue that any further. But all in all, we should try to maintain a positive attitude. And at least, you know, uplift the ones around us if we can. And with that, let's turn to Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4, verse 29. Well, I'm in the wrong spot already. That was Matthew 4. But we'll get there. Ephesians 4, 29. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. So if we're going to talk, it's nice if we can say and talk about uplifting things. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, with whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. And get rid of all bitterness, rage, anger, brawling, and slander, along with every form of malice. So that's not always easy to do, but that's what we need to try to do. And just write down on the same page on my Bible, chapter 5, verse 1, it says, "Be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children." And we, of course, we are His children. "And live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave Himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God." And skip down to verse 19, same chapter. It says, "Speak to one another with psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Sing and make music in your heart to the Lord, always giving thanks to God the Father for everything in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ." And, you know, I've found that when, you know, I am kind of depressed and everything seems to be going wrong, good uplifting music to me is a really beneficial. And I know we all remember the story of King Saul of ancient Israel, when he would get into fits of depression and rage, that his attendants would call for David to come in and play and sing to him. And it seemed to help him also. And then I want to talk about something I'm sure we all have trouble with, and that's trying to tame the tongue. Trying to, you know, like I said earlier, not speak hurtful things, but to speak uplifting things. And trying to tame the tongue is very hard. And I found, out in life that I seldom get in trouble when I listen, but sometimes when I talk, and you can say something hurtful, and it takes a long time to get to overcome that. You know, it's easy to hurt someone's feelings. It's hard to regain their trust. But let's turn to James chapter 3. James chapter 3, 5 and 6. Here he's talking about the tongue. He said, likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest fire is set by a small spark. Verse 6, the tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person and sets the whole course of his life on fire. And it itself set on fire by hell. So it sounds like we need to really work on that to control it, what we say. Verse 9. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's image. Out of the same mouth comes praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be. And there again, it's not an easy task, but we need to make every effort to control our tongue, control our anger, be slow to anger and quick to forgive. It's what we should be. It seems like we're wired just the opposite. We want to do just the opposite. And in Proverbs, we don't need to turn there unless you want to, but in Proverbs 15, 30, and verse 30, it says, a cheerful look brings joy to the heart, and good news gives health to the bones. I know we all like good news, and when you're around people that are in an uplifting mood and joyful and smiling, I think it does make us feel better. So we need to try to be that way as much as possible. And same chapter in Proverbs, verse 1, it says, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. And I think we all have seen that happen. You know, when a person comes to you and they're angry about something, maybe they're a little bit yelling at you. If you fly back in the same way, it's like throwing gas on the fire. It just goes out of control. But a soft answer will tend to short-circuit that anger. Kind of goes along with being humble, I think. And in closing, let's turn to Matthew 5, where I was a while ago. In my Bible, it's captioned the Beatitudes. And since we're talking about attitudes, it seems appropriate. Verse 3, it says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And just as an aside, it doesn't say kingdom in heaven, but it says kingdom of heaven. And so here, poor in spirit, I think, is humble people. Blessed are the humble, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Verse 5, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. So it's good to be meek, not arrogant, puffed up, and too proud of yourself. And the last one I'm going to read here is, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. And that's exactly what we want to be. And if we are humble and meek, it's much easier and more likely to be a peacemaker for sure. Thanks for your attention.
Today's message has to do with Romans 13. I have often wondered why Romans 13 was in the Bible, and I'm beginning to understand more so, and I think you'll see it too as we look at what's going on in the world and what Paul wrote. You could say the title of this message is Why Romans 13, or subtitle, The Value of Law and Order. So let's look at Romans 13 and read what Paul wrote that many people have wondered about and argued about and disagreed about. Romans 13. We're going to look at first verse 1 and 2. Romans 13, verse 1 and 2. And Paul writes, "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves." Now, when people look at that, they say, wait a minute. This is the Roman Empire. You know, Pax Romana, you know, peace in the world because of Rome's power. They did have elections in Rome, but the elections, were, at least if I understand correctly, were only in the city of Rome, and the only parliament was the Roman Senate. All the rest of the people in the empire were subject to whatever the Romans decided, and we could talk about bad emperors at another time, but people said, well, wait a minute, that's undemocratic. But Paul is telling them to be subject to a government that's undemocratic. Well, I mean, they had some elections for the people in Rome, but most people were not citizens and didn't live in Rome and had no say. You know, from an American point of view, it sounds bad. And you could ask, well, through the centuries, Christians have been under quite a few other undemocratic governments. And people say, wait a minute. How can Paul say be subject to the authorities that exist when those authorities don't seem to be godly or democratic or whatever good terms you'd use? And that's why what Paul wrote is so upsetting to a lot of people, controversial. And I'm beginning to understand Paul's wisdom more so. Obviously, Paul is right. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I want to understand why he's right. We're beginning to understand it. If you go back to the 60s, at least I believe it was, especially became true in 1968 when the radicals in Chicago at the Democratic National Convention labeled all police as pigs. And they had all those days of riots and beat up the pigs. And you know, that was the first, at least in my memory, of large-scale open disrespect for the police and authorities, and, you know, the constituted authorities. And they criticized Mayor Daley. And anyway, those who were there old enough can remember it, or you can look it up online. And do you know that label stuck? They still call the police pigs to this day. And I realized, well, it's just a word. I understand it's just a word. But it encapsulates disrespect for authority. You're just pigs. You know, fry them in a blanket. You understand. I mean, that's what they're saying now. But it comes out of that same root from 1968 when it got started. And it undermines authority. And many of the radicals who were there, like Bill Ayers and others, either they are now in authorities and, you know, in higher education and in the government, and or their children and followers are in power now, the people who started that. Many of the people in the press were educated by people who were in that radical group that disrespected authority. So we're in an age where at least a chunk of the leadership kind of goes along with disrespecting authority, disrespecting police, undermining the police, undermining authority. And what we're finding is urban crime is catapulting. And I'm going to give my opinion. The reason why urban crime is catapulting, I mean, there are many reasons, you know, fatherless kids and all that. But there's another reason, too. When you undermine authority, who is the most vulnerable to be sucked into that lawless attitude? It would be the people who live in the inner cities where all those poor people are concentrated without, at least in many cases, good family values. And they're going to be the most vulnerable to those bad influences. And, oh, I got a justification now to go shoot a cop. I mean, that's how some of them would think. I realize you're going to say, no good, responsible citizen would think that way, but we're talking about the inner city. You don't have a whole lot of, especially among young men, a lot of good, responsible people. Let me just give you some stats I looked up just recently. There are more, but this is just a few. I don't want to make this about stats. This is the rise in homicides from 2014 to 2015. Obviously, the year is not out for cities like Chicago, but at the rate they're going, they may break another record 2016, but we'll see when the end of the year comes. Homicides are up 70% in Milwaukee, 60% in St. Louis. That's our metropolitan area. 60%. And it's not like St. Louis was a basket full of angelic people and no crime. Homicides up 60%. Baltimore, 56%. And it's going to be higher this year because of what they've done to the police there. My opinion, we'll see, I guess, when the year's over. Washington, D.C., 40%. Chicago, 20%. Now, you look at those numbers, hey, well, Chicago's not doing so bad. The problem with that is Chicago's numbers were already record high already, much higher than the beer wars of Al Capone, much, much higher. These gang wars are much higher. Actually, many weekends in Chicago would compare to casualties in Iraq or Vietnam. I mean, because I remember those days well. You know, how many got killed in Iraq this week? 40 or 50. How many got killed in Chicago? The numbers are often comparable. So even though Chicago didn't jump as much as the other cities, they were already way record high. And I want to just make that point. Okay, let's go to Romans 13, 3 and 4. You can disagree with me afterwards, tell me you don't agree that undermining authority is not why these homicides are going up, but it is at least a major factor. It's at least a major factor. 13:3, for rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authorities? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. Generally speaking, the police and the judges, they're not after good law-abiding people. They're after people that cause trouble. I'm not saying there aren't problems here and there, but for the most part, even in the Roman Empire, that was true. You know, the one good thing you can say about the Roman Empire, I'm not saying there weren't some episodes, and they did have some civil wars, but most of the time, and it lasted for centuries, prior to the Roman Empire, had all these little city-states that warred with each other all over the place. But when Rome conquered what was the known civilized world at the time, I think they got up to the border of Scotland. I don't think they got into Scotland, but from England all the way back, all across what was the civilized world, all of North Africa, they had peace because it was enforced by the Roman legions. Every now and then the pirates got out of hand, but you can read stories where Caesar built a fleet and chased the pirates off the ocean, so it was relatively safe, you know, all that sea in between for world trade. And they built highways. You can get some old history, ancient books. They built highways all the way around the Roman Empire, and all roads eventually led to Rome, but they went all around the empire, all across North Africa, the Middle East, some other areas, which I can't remember all the technical names for them, but we would call it Eastern Europe, swing around Turkey, in across Europe, up to Spain, and down the Italian peninsula. And parts of those roads are used today. The Romans were good engineers. And that's like 2,000 years ago. The point I want to make is Rome did enforce a level of peace. You can even see it in the book of Acts. In some places when they rioted because Paul brought in some new religion that the pagans didn't like, the city clerk would say, wait a minute, we can't have all this rioting. We're going to have to explain to Rome for this. You all go home and be quiet and shut up. If you have problems with Paul and his religion, take it to court. Christianity couldn't have spread around the world except for the order and peace that the Roman Empire imposed. Now, admittedly, sometimes when somebody rebelled, they got a little brutal. Like if one city rebelled, they went in really tough. So I'm not saying they handled any things in a Christian gentility, but they did have law and order. And if you didn't obey the law, I mean, if you didn't disobey the law, you didn't have to fear them that much. And paid your taxes. They were tough on you. You had to pay your taxes. Sort of like the IRS, but verse 4, for he is a God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. Now it's the pistol, but same principle. For he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. And people are very upset by those scriptures. Now, most of us do not yet live in areas that are lawless, you know, where crime is run amok. Part of what has helped America, crime statistics, the population is older. If you could go back 30 years and prior, a larger percentage of the population were young people. Young people, this is just a crime fact. Young people are more likely to be violent and commit felonies. Even criminals, when they get older, they do less crime. When you get 55 and 60, you just, you know, not running the streets robbing and stealing and beating up people. And, you know, it's just not in you. So the majority of our population is older now. So even if you see crime stats overall smaller, don't think that means that we're in an age of law and order. But in the inner cities, crime is up. The statistics I read. And it's up because they have been undermining law and order. And it's up among younger people. And that's the way things are. Verse 5, Romans 13, 5. Therefore, you must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. Now, that also bothered people. Because you're saying, Paul is saying you have to be subject to the government. And that means the police. And then when in appropriate circumstances, the soldiers as well. At least the Roman legions in his case. But maybe, you know, they may call out the riot police for certain things. You're supposed to be subject to those people. And Paul says for conscience sake. That means all of us, have a spiritual obligation to obey the police. Or, like, say, if they call out the National Guard or something, to obey the National Guard, even if you don't agree and the policeman isn't all that nice, you have a moral responsibility. Most of the bad shootings happen when people resist arrest. And I'm not saying I know all the details of all the shootings. Maybe each one's unique. But if they tell you to show your hands, hold your hands up, put your hands on the car because they think you got a gun, the wise thing would be to follow orders, right? And I'm just saying that. And it's against the law to resist arrest, but you know, as I say, the attitude in the inner city has been pumped up in many cases. The police are pigs and we are going to... Well, I don't know exactly what goes beyond that, but that's when you get into trouble. But Paul says we have a spiritual duty to be cooperative and obey law and order, whether you voted for him or not. Verse 6 and 7. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers, attending continually to this very thing. Render, therefore, to all their due taxes. Remember when they tried to trick Christ, they wanted him to oppose the Roman taxes because they wanted the Roman Empire to grab him and do him in because they knew the Roman Empire would not tolerate leaders opposing paying taxes to Rome. And what did Christ say? He showed him the coin. And I just thought it was nice the way Christ did it. If I can do this well. This is one of Jesse's coins. And he said, whose picture is on this coin? Caesar's picture. In other words, the Roman Empire issued money and they controlled the financial of the world as it was. And he said, give to Caesar what's Caesar. His critics couldn't, you know, what are they going to say? He told them, give Caesar what is Caesar's. That means you should pay your taxes. If the taxes are too high, you can vote for the party that promises to lower them. But until they get lowered, we have to just put up with it, right? Because Christ said, give to Caesar what is Caesar, and give to God what is God. And even if it's a hardship, it was better than the alternative. At least, as I said, actually, the Roman Empire provided fresh water. They had a lot of great water aqueducts. Some are still, parts of them are still available that went into big cities like Rome and Ephesus and Alexandria. You can see them in history books. They did provide services for the taxes. You know, there probably was some, you know, they did some wasted money on the arena and big games, but, you know, we're not saying they're perfect. But the taxes were not totally wasted, and our taxes are wasted too, but we do get some services from our taxes. here's the part that bothers people also. Verse 7. Do customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. That means you have to show a certain honor to judges, honor to policemen that's appropriate, honor the top political powers like governors, even if you don't like them. And I know that's a grating scripture to people that say, wait a minute, you're kidding me. We have to speak respectfully of government officials. Now, you can disagree with them because America has freedom of speech. but there's a certain amount of that, and especially the police. And I find if the police stop you, if you're nice and friendly and smiling, I just got off a ticket recently. They didn't give it to me because I was so friendly. Anyway, I'll tell you about that later. But the problem is, be friendly and respectful, whether they give you the ticket or not. Life doesn't end. You know, whatever happens, happens. I'm going to tell you a story. The story is called The Bacon Tree. You got to listen carefully to get this one, The Bacon Tree. Okay, a group of early settlers, the days of the Old West and the Conestoga wagons, they were on the Oregon Trail, going to the West Coast. They got off the trail and they were lost deep in the West. They set up camp one night, worrying about running out of food. And as nightfall fell, they saw a campfire way off in the horizon up the creek. They thought, well, there's another group. So next morning, they moved their wagons up there to see if they could find out, how to get back on the trail, where food was. And they told a little man who was a rabbi, by the way, he was dressed, came out of a cave, and they said, "We're lost and we're hungry. Can you help us?" He thought for a moment and said, I have very little food that I can share with you. I can only share the water in this stream. I know only that there's a bacon tree about a mile and a half up the road, west of here, along this stream. And that's what I heard from others, a bacon tree. They couldn't wait. Oh, they packed up their bags. They got the wagons going, a bacon tree, a bacon tree. They were so excited. Well, when they got to the place, he said, it turned out it was a bunch of outlaws. And they weren't so glad to see this wagon train because they didn't have much to steal. But they pounced on them, beat them up, roughed them up, and took what little they had. So the leader went back to the rabbi because he wanted to know what went wrong. How could you tell us that? He said, you said there was a bacon tree and all we found was an ambush of horse thieves and outlaws. The rabbi thought for a moment, adjusted his round glass and said, oy vey, ambush, bacon tree. Who knew the difference? Ham bush. H-A-M. Ham bush is up the bacon tree. He got it all mixed up. he doesn't need bacon anyway. Ham bush. Anyway, it kind of relates to my topic, so I threw it in there. There are outlaws out there, and our government people should not say things that create an atmosphere that gives the outlaws a justification to be acting like outlaws, because it's going to start breaking down society. Some parts of some big cities are starting to decay already. And I'm giving you my opinion, but as they have riots and crime rates go higher and higher in certain parts of the city, do you think any of the businesses that have been destroyed will rebuild in those areas? Not likely. It'll be gone, most likely, for many, many years. That's less jobs, less services, and you see all these boarded up buildings, and you look at some places, you'll see what I mean. That's the cost of no law and order. So when Paul wrote what he said, I don't think he was saying the governments were perfect or anything like that. What he was saying, the lack of law and order is the worst thing, or one of the worst things a society can have, and Christians should not contribute to a lack of law and order. And it actually would help Christians avoid persecutions and stuff too, if people know that they are good citizens. Romans 13, verse 8 through 10. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandment, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. You shall not covet. And I think some of the radicals, when they want to get everybody fired up against the rich, aren't they really playing on coveting? And you know how that worked out for the communist empire. Take it from the rich. It doesn't work, by the way. It was a horrible thing. But it appeals to the desire to covet. They got more than me. Let's take it from them. We'll get the government to do it for us. And if there's any other commandment, all is summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, you should be a good neighbor. You should be a good neighbor in your block, a good neighbor in the town you live in. You should be known as a good neighbor who's not going to go into your neighbor's garage and steal his stuff. Or if some of his stuff happens to get in your yard by mistake, you'll take care of it and give it back to him, you know, some appropriate time away. We should be known as good neighbors, good people who, if you want to call it Christian love or something like that. So you're going to ask the question, well, when can we disobey the government? Let's go to Acts 5. There is a time when you can disobey the government. Most of us know this story, but I'm just going to read it. Acts 5, verse 25 to 29, of when you can disobey your government. Acts 5, 29. This is shortly after the apostles got started preaching the gospel, after Christ left. And the religious leaders at the time were scared spitless of Christianity, and they tried to arrest Peter, and obviously God's angel rescued him. And here's what happened. Acts 5, verse 29. But Peter and the other apostles... verse 25. So one came and told them, saying, his religious leaders, look, the men whom you put in prison are standing in the temple and teaching the people. God got them out overnight with some fabulous miracle. Then the captain went with the officers and brought them without violence, for they feared the people. In other words, they probably said, we don't want to take you by force because the mob might stone us. The police officer said, would you go with us quietly? And they went with the police quietly. They didn't ask the mob to attack the police, which they probably could have, and they might have succeeded. I just want to show you that example. They apparently went with the temple police officers quietly, didn't start a riot. The captain went to officers and brought them without violence, for they feared the people, lest they should be stoned. Because the people liked what the apostles were saying. Verse 27. And when they had brought them, they set them before the council and the high priest and asked them. Verse 28. Now these are the people who have some authority in the Jewish world of those days. Did we not strictly command you not to preach or teach in the name of Christ? And you have disobeyed us and filled all Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood on us. But Peter, verse 29, and the other apostles answered and said, here's when you can disobey the government. We ought to obey God rather than men. In other words, when there's a conflict between what this book says and what you believe a good Christian should do and what the government's telling you to do, you should obey God first. If the government therefore punishes you, so be it. If you suffer for the name of Christ, that's to your glory. And I'm not going to read the rest of it, but they were actually happy to suffer for the name of Christ. You just got to think of it that way. But they didn't start a riot. They didn't pull out swords and try to duke it out with the temple guards. They got a beating. I don't really know exactly the details, but they probably got a paddling, what we would call a paddling. I think the Jews gave you 39 swats because they couldn't give more than 40. They would one for safety's sake because they miscounted. So they got a hard paddling, but it didn't stop them from preaching the gospel. They did the right thing, and God blessed them and protected them. And like I said, they couldn't even keep Peter in jail. And you can think of the frustration. So God's first, the government second. That could become important in years to come. We should pray that it doesn't, but it could become important that if the government tells you to disobey God, you obey God, and that's to our credit and our honor, and don't worry about it. God will take care of us one way or the other. And by the way, this is not the time for violent revolutions. This is Satan's era until Christ comes back in a few years. What happens in most violent revolutions? You took the Cuban Revolution and the Russian Revolution, but you could list a whole list of other revolutions. They went from bad government to much, much, much worse government. That's what happens in most revolutions. The new revolutionary, like Castro, he put all his political prisoners in jail. He and Che Guevara killed thousands of Cubans, so much so that they got on rickety little lifeboats to float to Miami, which is risking your life, and shark-infested waters to get away. And people escaping the Iron Curtain, well, it's, you know, Everybody knows how bad it was. The point I'm getting at, in this Satan's era, most revolutions go from bad to worse. So that is not, and I know there are a lot of anarchists in the streets. So far, they have not been able to really shake up America, I think, the way they want it. The Wall Street rioters and some of the other anarchy groups. But they're going to be out there causing more law and disorder. And if they don't get the president they want, it may even get worse. I mean, the anarchists. But we are not going to support such people. Don't get any of those riots. I think the Bible would say respect the office, even if you don't respect the politician who holds the office. Respect the office. Do not riot. What about free speech? That's always a big one. We do have free speech in America, so you can criticize the government. And theoretically, as Lincoln says, it's the government by the people, of the people, for the people. We are Caesar. I know that's only a theory. It's not real. But theoretically, we get the government we deserve, as Mr. Hill said. But the truth is, we want our speech to build people up and not cause more lawlessness. And we should pray to God that He allows us to have the leaders and, to some extent, the media that will encourage peace and law and order, because I think we are lacking in those areas now. I was in St. Louis before the Ferguson riots. We flipped around TV stations. They pretty much told a lot of young people, if you don't get what you want in this grand jury verdict, you're justified to riot, loot, and burn. And I'm saying that's what the St. Louis media was saying. I was there, and that's the clear message I got. I thought, this is crazy. I could criticize some of our politicians there, too, for aiding to it. But and you can look at the Rodney King thing. Over media coverage of Rodney King's beating caused riots that 50 people got killed in. There was a foreign professor, this is many years ago, he asked about that, and I said, yeah, I agree. It was stupid. But you can blame it on the media. They jump to judgment, they rush to judgment, they overcover stuff, and our media is bad. Our media is bad, let's face it. As the years go on and you study media and the way they treat stories, you'll see more and more they are an agent of anarchy and chaos. Not all of them, but more than they should be. Pray that we get better media. There are three theories about Christians in government. Let me expose you quickly to the three theories. One is Christians cannot work for the government, cannot vote for the government, cannot serve the government in any way, shape, or form. And you have groups like the Amish, and I'm not criticizing them, I'm merely saying, and some lesser groups, they stay totally divorced from everything, especially the government. Second theory is you have two spheres of life. You have the worldly sphere and the spiritual sphere, and you treat the two as totally separate from each other, so you don't let any of your spiritual thinking influence what you do in the real world. And the third theory is we Christians have a responsibility to try and make the government better, make our communities better, and to participate appropriately. I'll just ask this question. If all the people who believe in the Bible and Christian principles stay home and don't vote, leave picking the government in the hands of the ungodly and the anarchists, what kind of government do you think we're going to get? I'll let you decide that one for yourself. If the non-Bible believers do all the choosing, well, you can imagine the kind of government we're likely to get. But everybody can make their own choices. Our church has said people can make their own choices about all those things, the service and voting. You can decide for yourself whatever you want to do. But what I would say is, regardless of what you decide to do, pray that we can get the best government we can have in this world so we can live peaceably, and the best government we can have so the gospel can go forward. Remember we talked about the Great Wall in China that they put up that blocks a lot of our internet stuff from China now. I hope they get that Chinese people get to take that down. And I'm told there's some countries in the Middle East that have their other they block a lot of stuff that they don't want in, Christian stuff and political stuff they don't agree with. That's inhibiting the gospel. And there are governments, including some in our government, want the government to regulate and tax the internet. And their excuse will be, well, there are crimes on the internet. We can stop some of that. Yes, I suppose that's true. But if the government starts controlling it, can you see access to truths that they don't like would get blocked? And maybe the internet, you know, some people think God says there will be a door that can't be closed. Maybe it's the internet. I don't honestly know whether that's true or not. We'll just have to wait and see. But pray that the gospel will not be stymied by governments that want to block the truth. Let's go to 1 Timothy 5. There are a lot more scriptures we could cover. I just want to cover two scriptures here. I meant to cover Colossians 4 first. Colossians 4 first. Colossians 4, verse 3. Colossians 4, 3 reads, "Meanwhile, praying also for us that God would open to us a door for the word, to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I am also in chains." So he wants them to pray that the powers that be will not inhibit the gospel. Now, 1 Timothy 2, and there are other scriptures you go to, but these are the key ones. 1 Timothy 2, verse 1 and 2, or at least some of the key ones. "I therefore exhort you, first of all, that supplications and prayers and intercessions and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings, and for all who are in authority." That means you should pray for your governor, your president, your mayor, for judges, so the Supreme Court. You may not agree with them, but pray that they'll get some wisdom. God will inspire them, that they won't mess up too much. However you want to word it, that's how I would take it. "Pray for all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence." You don't want them passing laws that are going to restrict religious freedom. And there are countries where a lot of religious freedom, you can't preach certain scriptures, even in your churches. And there are people who want to do that in America. Even in your churches, they don't want certain verses preached. So pray for law and order.